This is Pulse.
Hello, and you're listening to Pulse Radio, LSCSU's official radio station. My name's Mike Pearson.
And my name is Christina Meisko.
And you're listening to The Interview Hour.
Each Friday between 5 to 6 on The Interview Hour, we'll be talking to distinguished figures from the fields of politics, current affairs, arts and academia.
We'll try and find out how they became interested in their field, discuss their career as a whole, and talk about the relevant issues of the day.
You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/theinterviewhour or on our website at www.pulselsc.co.uk.
If you want to join the debate on Twitter, it's #interviewhour, or if you want to email the show, it's theinterviewhour@pulselsc.co.uk.
Now, we're joined in the studio today by a former cabinet minister. He grew up in London and became a postman and worked his way up through the unions to become an MP for Hull West and Hesel in 1997.
He became Minister for Higher Education in 2003 and then went through spells as Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, before graduating to become Education, Health and then Home Secretary.
Alan Johnson, MP, welcome to Pulse Radio. So we thought we'd just start with your personal life and background a little bit. Back in 1970, when you were our age, did you ever think that you would go into politics?
No, not for a second. I'd left school at 15, stacking shelves at Tesco's. When I was 18, I joined the post office. By the time I was 20, I was married with three kids, living on a council estate in Slough. Just about to start this long strike, seven-week strike, in January 71, which was just when my son was born, so I was still 20 years of age. Then my youngest child. So 7 weeks, no money coming in, no strike pay. It was pretty tough. It kind of politicised you, and I was already interested in politics. Did it make me think of a future in politics? Not at all, not for one second.
And during your career, would you say that there was a turning point in which you were suddenly inspired and you realised that you had the opportunity to enter politics?
No, I did it in a strange way. I was trade union leader. I'd become a union representative, then got on a national executive, then become a national officer, then become general secretary. And that meant I sat on the NEC of the Labour Party. And in the run-up to the 97 election, Tony Blair said to me, "Are you interested in being an MP?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, I'd quite like to have people coming in as MPs." I mean, at that time, it was just before the 97 election. There was a feeling we were going to win. He felt we needed more people in the Parliamentary Labour Party that hadn't spent all their lives trying to become an MP. And he had a number of seats, we know now, where the people who held those seats were going to retire at the last minute to spend more time with their peerage. And so after I thought about it, I thought, well, if you're going to change career completely, you better do it kind of in your mid-40s, otherwise you'll never do it.
Yeah.
So I saw Tony, I said, "Well, where would I stand?" He said, where do you want to? You know, there was all these seats coming up. And I ended up, thankfully, in a brilliant place, which was Hull. And in the 97 election, I came in as the candidate halfway through the general election. It was a six-week general election, a very long general election. John Major decided he wanted as long as possible to try and turn the opinion polls around. And for the first 3 weeks, I was general secretary of the CWU, helping my good friend Malcolm Wicks, who sadly died recently in Croydon North, as it was then. And then for the last 3 weeks, I was suddenly parachuted into Hull. So there were not even any signs in the window saying vote Johnson. But I got the biggest vote ever recorded for a Labour candidate in that seat, which just shows you that if any MP thinks that their vote is all about their personal wisdom and integrity and their sagacity and their charm, it's not. It's really about the party. In this country, you're elected on a party ticket, invariably. And it was the popularity of the Labour Party at the time that got me that vote. But I'm very pleased that I made the change.
After 15 years as a MP for Hull, do you feel a particular affinity to the city now?
Oh, gosh, affinity. You know, it's a funny thing about Hull. I mean, this probably won't be heard in Hull, so even if I did slag it off, no one would hear it. But an MP wouldn't
slag it off. Well, I'm from there, Hull, so...
Are you? Yes. Right, well, you might pass the message on. Do you know, I love the place, and you find loads of people who didn't come from Hull. who just think it's the most amazing place. And it's got a great university for a start. So you get lots of students who arrive in Hull thinking, hearing all these grim stories about the north, never mind Hull. And, you know, it was the biggest fishing port in the world. All that collapsed after the Cod Wars in the early 70s. Fishermen got no compensation, no retraining, no nothing. They were just dumped on the Dole queue. And that was the lifeblood of Hull. It's taken a long time for it to recover, but what a place. I mean, you know, where it's the poetry. One of my predecessors, as well as being William Wilberforce, was one of my predecessors. He was the MP for Hull when he ended Britain's involvement in the slave trade. Andrew Marvell was the MP, the great poet, was one of my predecessors. There's Philip Larkin, there's Stevie Smith, who wrote Not Waving But Drowning, who comes from Hull. It's a great poetic city, and it's a fabulous part of the world. Where do you come from, Mike?
Beverley. So it's just that road, yeah.
7 miles away.
Yeah.
Speaking of writers, how do you actually find writing your own book at the moment? Or
I've had a great time. I've been doing it for a year.
Yeah.
Is it hard work balancing writing the book and being an MP?
Well, I wouldn't have been able to do it if I was a government minister. So, you know, for 11 years I was a minister, and that does take over your whole life. And when you're a cabinet minister, it's just, you know, it's a way of life. I'm not complaining about that. It's great fun. You shouldn't, you know, don't take the job if you don't want to do the hard work. But you couldn't possibly write a book at the same time. I mean, William Hague went off when he stepped down as leader of the opposition, remember, and wrote two very good biographies, one of William Wilberforce and the other of William Pitt. He could have never done that, William, as a front bencher, and I could have never written this book on the front bench.
Of course.
I had great fun doing it. I really enjoyed it.
Was it weird reflecting back on your life, and in retrospect, is there any advice you'd offer us if we were interested in going into politics at this age?
Well, it's a childhood memoir, so it's up to the age of 18. And really, I tried to recreate my mother, who died when I was very young, and my sister, who in effect, brought me up. Well, I don't have to recreate her because she's still around. But so, and it's trying to catch that time. It was Notting Hill. It was during the race riots. There was a terrible murder of Kelso Cochrane, which was kind of Stephen Lawrence 20 years earlier, which happened on the corner of my street. So I'm trying to capture all of that. Advice for people wanting to go into politics, I get that all the time because we have lots of politics students at Hull University and elsewhere. And I guess, you know, part of the advice would be kind of harking back to what Tony Blair said to me, is go and do something else and then think about a political career.
Do you think at the moment in politics there's a severe lack of people who have genuine life experience?
I do think there's an issue here. And, you know, you can get to a kind of inverted snobbery where because you've been a postman you're somehow thought of as landed gentry in Labour terms. But, you know, if you looked at Parliament 20, 30 years ago, it wouldn't be unusual to have a postman or a steelworker or a coal miner or people who'd done other things in professional careers.
So why do you think that dynamic's changed then over the past 30 years?
I don't know. I would think it's the introduction of special advisers, which kind of started in the 70s, which then gives you a route, which actually, if you look at all the party leaders, Clegg, Cameron, and Ed Miliband, they've all taken that route. They study, sometimes they do a postgrad, then they perhaps do something. I mean, Cameron mucked around at Carlton Television for a while, and Clegg did a few things, but basically they're looking for an opening to come in as a special advisor. They come in as a special advisor, and then they look for a parliamentary seat, and then they get a parliamentary seat. And as a result, it's a very closed world for them, and it's the closed world of the Westminster Village.
So just one last question on your background. This is a bit of a silly one, but what do you do to relax? Just to kind of get an insight into the real Alan Johnson.
Loads of things. Music. I love music. I play the guitar. I play the piano badly. I read a lot. I've always read. And I play tennis, and I support Queen's Park Rangers.
Very, very busy life, along with writing a book. Really, really busy. Okay, so let's go on to ministerial life. And when in cabinet, which position did you enjoy the most?
Health, probably. I mean, I didn't. Most people think the Home Office is a kind of poison chalice, but I enjoyed that and I had fun at the Home Office. It's important to have fun. Whatever you're doing in life, have fun, and if it's not fun, go and do something else. But health was particularly good. I was there for 2 years. It was the
When I was there, we celebrated the 60th anniversary of the NHS, so there's a lot of activity around that, including finding people who were there when the NHS was created, and probably when we get to the 70th anniversary, sadly, they won't be around. So people like Nye Bevan's secretary worked for him in his constituency. And we did a lot of good things on health, and it was just a joy working with people in the NHS.
What would you consider your greatest achievement then, overall, in your ministerial life?
I did introduce student fees. Maybe we'll come on to that later as higher education minister, which I thought was the right thing to do, although I disagree profoundly with the way it's gone now. What would I think? I think it was looked after children when I was at education. We had a real effort to try and stop this terrible kind of conveyor belt of what happens to looked after children. They're pushed into care sometimes when there's a family member who means they don't have to be institutionalised. They're moved around all the time. They get the worst scores because whenever they end up with a new foster parent or whatever, you know, they go to the school with all the vacancies, and that's usually not the best school around. And then they're pushed out of care. They were pushed out of care at age 16. Get out and fend for yourself. So it was a terrible situation. And if you look at the statistics, looked after children, 0.5% of the children of the child population, 27% of the prison population. So, you know, something really bad is happening there. And so we introduced measures to make sure local authorities were, in effect, the proxy parent of these children. They had a responsibility to act like a parent in their best interests. They weren't pushed out at 16 anymore. They had a right to go to whatever school they wanted to go to in the area, whether there were vacancies or not. Those kind of things, which I think made a difference. I had a brilliant minister working with me, Beverly Hughes, and that's probably my proudest achievement, although the human fertilisation and embryology bill was a close second.
Do you think you could have achieved more if you had fewer roles but for a longer period of time?
Because from the outside, if you're looking at it, you tend to think, how can one person have many different ministerial roles and have a deep understanding of different portfolios?
I've just been asked that because there's a select committee look at this, and there's also a guy writing a book about reshuffles and, you know, do you get reshuffled too much? Mm. And I think it's a fair point. I think Cameron was right not to have a reshuffle for 2 years. Some of the reshuffles are forced upon you. You know, Liam Fox, for instance, he had to fill his... But he didn't have a big... What would be a reshuffle rather than a shuffle. Did I feel that affected me? Yeah, it meant you couldn't... I mean, the education leaving age is going up to 18 because I started that in 2005. I went to Canada, saw what was happening there, came back, found an enormous consensus, convinced the Prime Minister. But that's how long it takes. I mean, it will actually... The education leaving age will go up from 2015. So that's a full 10 years from starting the process. Mm. So if you're in post just for a very short period of time, you don't even get much time to start these things, let alone finish them. So, yeah, I wish I hadn't been moved around so much. But given that every move was a promotion, I wasn't going to turn it down.
Speaking of you being in Canada, are you often inspired by policies of other European countries, for example?
Yeah.
And do you search for that inspiration, or is it usually just do you fall into it, basically?
I think, actually, you would be foolish as a politician or a Secretary of State if you didn't look at kind of things that are working elsewhere and in other countries. And so, for instance, in education, Finland was a very interesting country. You know, they don't start school till age 7. They don't push kids into kind of institutionalized education as early as we do, but they have these startling results, and every child is speaking 3 languages by the time they're 11. They start learning languages early, which is something I try to do with limited success. You know, I said that we should students should start learning languages age 7, not wait till they're in secondary school, you know, the earlier the possible, because they're absorbing it all. Mm. And then they shouldn't be forced to continue to do languages after age 14, 15. And part of that has been a failure because there's been fewer and fewer language graduates. But the first bit never really worked. You didn't get many. I've got a child who's just left primary school. Even though I was the education secretary and introduced that in 2006 with the help of Ron Deering, my son never got language lessons at age 7 or 8, so that bit's never really been properly done. Mm. But yeah, you learn from other countries and you look at things that work, and you would be foolish if you didn't at least look at whether they could be applied to UK situation.
I remember once hearing Phil Wallace, the former immigration minister, say that ministerial life is somewhat of a mix between Yes Minister, the thick of it, the West Wing and EastEnders. I'm not sure what part of EastEnders you had in mind.
I don't know what EastEnders.
But do you think that's an accurate assessment?
Yeah, I mean, you can see on Yes Minister, and in particular the thick of it, it's an exaggeration, but like all really good satire, at the heart of that exaggeration is a central truth, you know, that actually it's not about things being planned to perfection, and, you know, things happen. And I was saying, I did something, they're bringing Yes Minister back again next year, so I've done a documentary that's shown in January with me and Michael Heseltine and Alistair Campbell sitting around chewing the fat, and I actually said I was in the plot of the thick of it when I took over at DTI, and I was told the department is changing its name, the Department of Productivity, Energy, which is always spelled with a big E and a small N,
yes.
Industry and Science. I said, that makes me Secretary of State for Peanuts. And that was absolutely true. And I had to go to Tony Blair and say, look, they've taken down a DTI sign, which has been there for many years from 1 Victoria Street. They haven't put the new sign up yet. Why do we have to make this change? He said, I don't know. Whose idea was this? And he looked around at all his advisors. Anyway, we remained as DTI. But, you know, it's an example. It would be a great plot for Thick of It, that one.
Mm. I'm very surprised a lot of the time when I'm watching the Thick of It, how many parallels there are between the Thick of It and real life.
Yeah, they know their stuff. They've got a lot of good inside information as to how special advisors and communications departments and all of that intertwined. And the latest one on the coalition, I mean, I should imagine there's a few people in the coalition thinking, yeah, who gave them that? This is a documentary, not a comedy programme.
And in terms of politics, how do you rate Ed Miliband's performance as a leader at the moment?
Good. Yeah, I didn't vote for Ed. I voted for David. But he has, I think, particularly since not just last week's conference speech, but the previous year's, which didn't get the huge coverage, but the predators versus producers, I think he's hit a vein here that none of the other party leaders are doing. I mean, people have gone through almost an experience that is equivalent, without all the carnage, of the Second World War. And when people came out of the Second World War, there's no way they were going to go back to the 30s. And there was a real mood that things had to change. And you had huge changes: the Butler Education Act, the introduction of the welfare state, start of the National Health Service. I think there's a mood like that now after, you know, MPs' expenses, phone hacking scandal, the banking scandals, the LIBOR scandal, all of that, is we don't want to go back to business as usual. And Ed is trying to think through something that is quite exciting. It's not business as usual, which means you can't just come up with a few snappy policies, and it takes time to put flesh on that skeleton.
Do you think that's why he came out with the One Nation concept?
But yes.
Many people didn't really know what that really meant. I mean, politicians say One Nation all the time. You have Conservatives saying that. You have Ed Miliband saying that. But where's the substance to it?
Say it all the time, and they, you know, things like big society. There's nothing wrong with the idea of big society, which is you have, you know, people doing it for themselves and local charities and social enterprises, etc. The trouble is, Cameron thought of the title, but now it doesn't exist anywhere than on the number 10 website. So Ed's got to make sure he doesn't make that mistake. But there is a feeling that, you know, we're not all in this together, that there are people who are really doing well out of the latest situation. There are huge disparities. There's huge disparities now in pay. When I became a postman, you know, the boss, the postmaster general, was kind of getting something like 100 times my salary. Now it's something like 2,000 times the salary. These are huge. There's been a huge change in the rewards that people get at work, for instance. And so Ed, in this sort of effort to think these things through, One Nation is good because it steals it from the Conservative Party and makes the point that actually, although they talk about we're all in this together, millionaires are going to get a cut in their tax next April, and at the same time, some of the poorest and most vulnerable people in our society are going to lose money from their benefits. That doesn't look fair. And I think fairness is a big issue in this. And I think after the Olympics as well, there was a mood that people wanted to come together rather than be driven apart.
Do you think the Labour lead in the polls is due to Ed Miliband's performance or Conservative?
Well, he had the lead before in the polls. He got a bit of a bounce after that speech and deserved it. But look, governments lose elections. Mm. Oppositions don't win them. Governments lose them. And so there is always a factor. If the economy was going well, if the economy was going well as Osborne predicted it would by taking this this austerity path, this slash and burn approach to the economy, then you know they wouldn't be in so much trouble. I think the real problem for the government at the moment isn't anything ideological. It's about competence. There's a real question mark over their simple competence to run the country.
And could you let us know what you think of the current tuition fee policy?
I think it's wrong. I think most students understood when we introduced the policy in 2003-2004 that higher education real terms funding per pupil had gone down by 36%. There was no prospect. We talked then about the funding gap in higher education. If any money was coming from the taxpayer for education, there were huge needs in Sure Start, in primary education, in secondary education. The money would go there. It wouldn't go into higher education. Nevertheless, we did increase the funding from the taxpayer. But on the back of the Deering Commission, which had a representative of the National Union Students on it, which said, look, those who benefit from higher education should make a contribution. The society benefits, they should make a contribution through tax. Employers benefit. There's not much. Actually, that's been a closed shop about how they contribute. But the student benefits, and they should, once they've graduated, on a scale that was, you know, probably the best deal you could get. It wasn't like a credit card debt. You pay it back eventually. We set the threshold at, what was it then?
15,000.
And of course, 10 years later, we would have put it up to 21,000 as well. So cost of living and all that. Now that and that a large chunk of that money would go into reintroducing bursaries and grants for poorer kids, and it would all be attached to the AIM Higher program, where you're looking to get youngsters, give them the confidence to go to university.
I mean, critics do say when the tuition fees were raised to 3,000 and 9,000, it's because Labour said 50% of people had to go to university. We're trying to get more people into university when it's not right for everyone.
Right. Well, there's two issues to that. First of all, we never said 50% of kids had to go to university. We said 50% of 18 to 30-year-olds should be in higher education. Now, a big chunk of that were two-year vocational foundation degrees, which has been a huge success. You don't go anywhere near a university. If you go anywhere to an institute, you go to FE, but you do it mainly in the workplace. So that's a very different. And in any case, we should have been expanding higher education. It had been contracting. We should have been expanding it. Now, we did need some of that money to do that, but also some of that money to be offered as bursaries and grants, because the worst thing, I mean, poor kids would not be put off by the fee anymore. They were put off by the £1,000 up front. They didn't want to go to their parents and say, I need £1,000 to go to university. Didn't have to do that anymore. Nothing to do with their parents. They pay it back once they've graduated, once they're earning, on the same basis as anyone else, whatever background they come from. Their problem was they didn't have parents with a few bob to help them get through, to actually keep body and soul together. The student grant wasn't enough to do that. Mm. Bursaries and grants were very important, so a third of this money was going to go to bursaries and grants. What's the key issue, though? As Deering said, they should make a contribution. £1 in every 14. We said students should pay towards higher education. They shouldn't pay the whole costs of their higher education. Now, if you're studying arts, humanities, social sciences, there's no taxpayer contribution whatsoever. 80% cut in the teaching grant and a 9,000 fee. The problem is now the Treasury has taken over this. The Treasury always thought, this is a nice idea, introduce fees, and then eventually we can make students pay and you know, taxpayer won't. I mean, it actually is more costly because, of course, we have to pay the fees up front, but it doesn't show in the public sector borrowing requirement. There's a little kind of smoke and mirrors there. So I think now, you know, fees, we should have introduced a fee of around 5,000 rather than 3,000. We were frightened because of the difficulty of getting it through. We only got it through by four votes. Of course, the Tories, we had 179-seat majority. It wasn't Iraq that almost brought down the Blair government. That sailed through by 250 votes. It was tuition fees. And So it just about went through, and if we'd have tried to make it 5,000, we wouldn't have succeeded. So we put in this, it stays at 3,000 till 2010, then there's another review, and the problem was the review then, you know, well, actually, John Brown's review said it should be around 6,000, but with the ability to go above that, and the government made it 9,000. Which was, I think, you know, whatever, I know Nick Clegg's been apologising all over the place, but as a piece of political cynicism, to actually, to Lib Dem people had a really good line on on fees. The Tories just had a convenient line. They wanted to reduce the numbers going into higher education. They still do. The Lib Dems agreed that you needed more money in higher education. They were going to put a penny on the basic rate of tax. And they really believed that. They believed that fees would put poorer kids off. Of course, it hasn't. In fact, quite the opposite. The social class
gap. There is a communication problem in saying to children from poor backgrounds, you will be able to pay this off, and it's quite a manageable debt.
There is obviously a communication problem that you have to get around. You know, it's even worse with £9,000 fee, and you've seen lots of there's been a reduction in applications as a result of that. But no, what the government has done is abandon the Aim Higher program. If you start very young with kids and you make sure that they aspire to university, there's kids in west of Hull, Hull University might as well be on planet Pluto. I mean, you know, they just don't aspire to it. Mm. If you do all those things right, it doesn't just start when a kid gets to 18, it starts much younger than that. Bright kid gets to age 18, you know, two good A levels or whatever, and it has explained to them it's not going to cost your family nothing, it's not going to cost you anything until you've graduated, and this money helps to go in to make your higher education experience better. I mean, it's a non-starter. That's why most students, and the NUS actually, you know, understood the argument for fees. You have to make sure that you get the communication across. But look at the statistics. When it was free higher education with generous grants, post-Robbins, 63 onwards, the social class gap didn't close. It widened. Yes, there were more women going to university. That was great. Not more working class kids going to university. Was actually regressive in that sense. Since fees were introduced, it's closed by an enormous degree, 6%, closing the social class gap. So, I mean, that argument's over. It's a bit rich now we hear Nick Clegg making all those arguments because, of course, he campaigned so vociferously against fees when he knew, actually, that he would never be able to abolish fees, and neither did he want to. We've seen him. He actually supported the policy.
And what do you think of his apology recently?
It was very entertaining. Brilliant.
Do you think it was a wise move?
I don't think it was, because he wasn't apologising for actually, you know, for actually suggesting he was against a policy that he was actually in favour of. He was apologising because the coalition actually couldn't do what, you know, I mean, if you're going to be apologetic about it, at least be genuine in your apology. And this seemed to me like an apology that was drummed up by his PR people saying, look, it's very important before you go to Lib Dem conference, let's try and nail this down. And of course, it didn't work. It didn't work.
Do you think the timing was important that it was the Liberal Democrats trying to say, this is the past?
Yeah, because when 9,000 fees were in, when the 9,000 fee was introduced, this huge, he's against any fees at all, and then he's in favour of tripling them. He said, I make no apologies for this, it's the right policy, as if they had invented, you know, not paying until you graduated. I mean, it was our system. I mean, they put the threshold up, yeah, but that was our, it was exactly the system that they voted against in 2004. And it's fine. I mean, the Tories gave up on it. Boris came in as the shadow higher education minister, and Cameron came in and they said, oh, we're in favour of fees now. And they were only doing it as a, you know, to try and bring down the government. They actually agreed with the policy in the end. The Lib Dems never did that. They always carried on their opposition to it. So I think, you know, it takes a lot of explaining to go from we're going to abolish fees to we're going to treble them.
If we turn our attention to a different issue at the moment, the Eurozone, how do you see the situation in Europe playing out?
Well, I think that there will be a resolution of this, and it won't include Greece leaving the single currency. I mean, I don't see how Greece can leave the single currency without Greece wanting to leave the single currency. And it depends on unanimity, and Greece had the veto. So if there was so all this talk about Greece having to go, it's not going to happen. And for Merkel and for Germany and France in particular, seeing a country leave the Eurozone anyway, number one, they can't practically do it, but number two, even if they could, it would be a huge admission of defeat.
Do you think that's what is keeping this together?
Yes.
Political will as opposed to economic forces?
Yes, and the European Central Bank, of course, will have to play a more significant role, and that's the problem for Germany, because basically they fund it. And I can see that as a political problem for Merkel coming up to a general election. But it's not going to fall apart. It should have been, you know, the way that it was constructed in the first place was a fallacy, that you could have, monetary union without fiscal union, and that was never going to work. So I'm glad that we're outside of it, and I'm glad we're watching it from the sidelines, but it would be catastrophic for us if it did collapse, and I don't think it will.
In terms of EU democratic legitimacy, do you think that people generally understand enough about what goes on in EU institutions, or do you think that needs to be increased, the knowledge?
No, they don't understand enough, and there is a problem which the Conservatives and UKIP and all that might actually benefit from over and over again by some of this twaddle about, you know, all of our laws come from Europe and all that, which is a nonsense. I am absolutely, and I think most British people would be committed to the principle that in a continent where there were two world wars and millions of deaths in the 20th century, very recently in civilized countries, that after that, after the war, there was this famous cartoon, David Lowe, on the front page of the Daily Mirror, and it was a soldier leaving the battlefield scarred, and he held out the kind of the rosette, whatever you call it, of peace, and peace on it, and he was handing it out to the readers and saying, don't lose it again. And there was a real feeling that Europe had to combine. It was an economic issue as well, but it was also a political issue.
Do you think it'll combine more now and become more federalist in a sense, or
I don't think we're left
on the outside?
Well, I think there is a real danger of us being left on the outside, but I don't think Germans or
Dutch. Is that a good or bad thing?
I think it's a very bad thing that we're on the outside, and we're on the outside because of Cameron's silly incompetence back last December when he got a few good headlines for walking out, when he gained nothing. His so-called veto gained nothing, could have stayed at the table and influenced events. And now, I mean, for God's sake, for people in the Eurozone, serious people facing all these difficulties, to hear Britain whinging away on the sidelines of, we want to renegotiate our employment laws. I mean, you know, it would just be a joke in most areas, serious political areas of Europe. And I don't think it's going to get them anywhere. But, you know, the big issue is about, should there be a referendum?
Do you think Labour should offer a referendum?
No, I don't. But that's not the same as saying we won. I mean, I think, you know, the way the mood is going, that might be a possibility. I think it would be very bad. I don't know how you ask the kind of questions you would need to ask, because really, for most people, they would agree with what Cameron says. He doesn't think Europe's perfect, but he doesn't want to be out of it. Most people.
So it'll be a renegotiation then.
And then how do you put that? You know, if you say yes, no to entry. I took part in that referendum in 76 when there was a referendum, not under the Tories who took us in, but under Labour, and there was a very strong majority. And that's fine, but you don't keep asking. You don't ask, do you want to be part of the United Nations? Do you want to be part of NATO? Let's keep having a referendum on it. We're a parliamentary democracy.
I guess Conservatives and UKIP would say Europe has fundamentally changed since 1975, and it's more of a political union, less of a free trade area. That's what they would say. So how would you counter?
Well, no, I think what you can trace back are the times when Europe changed and there wasn't a referendum when there should have been a referendum. So there should have been a referendum if we'd gone into the single currency. Undoubtedly, it's a big constitutional change. There should have been a referendum on Maastricht. There should have been a referendum on Margaret Thatcher, who gave away most of the UK's, you know, if anyone's talking about giving up our powers to Europe, that was under the Single European Act. That was under Thatcher in the 80s, and there was no referendum. There's an argument, but it's a historical argument, about what you could do retrospectively. Mm. Now, if there was a fundamental change in the European Constitution, then it should go to a referendum. There wasn't a fundamental change 2 years ago. And I don't think there'll be a fundamental change now. If there is, then it's an argument for a referendum.
Do you think referendums actually reflect the question that's given to the population? For example, with the constitutional treaty with Holland and France, rejecting the constitutional treaty, do you think that was actually based on the proposal or because of a general impression of what the EU was and perhaps misunderstandings of what the EU was?
I think the question is all important. We're talking about that in terms of the Scottish referendum on whether they want to stay part of the union. The question is all important, which is why referendums are a really difficult way to proceed and why I really don't agree with government by referendum. I think it's too prone to the question being loaded for a start, to people being forced to make yes or no decisions on issues where there are shades of grey, 50 shades of grey, there are shades of grey and complexities that need to be discussed rather than a simple blunt yes or no.
So would you have had a referendum on, say, the voting system and electoral reform?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's an interesting story there, Mike, because when we were negotiating with the Lib Dems to try and form a coalition after the last government, it was hung by Parliament. The Lib Dems came to us, you might remember, on the Sunday night, having kind of broken off with the Tories. And they came to us and said, what we want is a change to alternative vote without any referendum of the British people. Just introduce it. Mm. And then further down the line, 3 years or so, a full-blown vote referendum on PR. We said to them, you can't change the voting system without a referendum. Mm. It's got to be alternative vote. The alternative vote has to be put to the British people.
But then, again, what's the difference between a constitutional issue like that and a constitutional issue like Scottish independence or Europe?
That has to go to... We had a referendum on a Scottish Parliament. We had a referendum on Welsh Assembly. We had a referendum on whether you want a London mayor. Those are issues where you should have a referendum. The big constitutional issues, yes, no. Very different to government by referendums. To, you know, every kind of change that happens, you have another referendum. We've got a mayor now in London. It won't change. Because the mayor takes on new powers, we won't have another referendum.
Actually speaking, we actually had questions submitted by some of our university colleagues, and John Allsop actually asked, would you consider standing for to become mayor of London? Because many people view you as an ideal candidate, so what would be your reply to that?
Johnson & Johnson. No, I thought about it whenever it was, a couple of years ago when we were choosing a candidate, 2010, and I thought about it and decided not to, really, because... You know, I'm committed to Hull West and Hessel for a start. I'm Beverly lad here that I love the area. So I didn't want to do that. The next election, I think I'll be too old anyway. And if I stand for re-election at Hull West and Hessel, which I plan to do in 2015, you know, that means if you stand in 2015 and say, I want to serve you for the next 5 years, you don't run off in 2016.
So there's absolutely no possibility of standing down in 2015 then going for it in 2016?
No possibility of that whatsoever.
Okay. John will be disappointed.
This one's from Sean Howlett. We don't really have time to really put a lot of meat on this bones because it's a big issue, but he says, why did you sack Professor David Nottingham as chief advisor?
Oh my good God, because I didn't have any faith in him as my advisor anymore. He'd got a yellow card off of Jackie Smith, he got the red card off of me. He made speeches being very clear that he was talking as the government's senior advisor, and that's the difference. He would make a speech about, you know, it's more dangerous to ride horses than it is to take ecstasy, which is what he was saying, and there's a lot of kids in my constituency who don't ride horses but have terrible problems with drugs. Saying that, making it quite clear, look, I'm not speaking as a government advisor on this, is one thing. Doing
so you would have any problem if he said, I'm not speaking as a government advisor, but I have these views?
No, absolutely. His views were his views. He has to, but it's a very important role to chair the Advisory Council on Misuse of Drugs. And the clue is in the title. It's the Advisory Council. I mean, his big problem was that having downgraded cannabis from B to C, we put it back up to B. Not me, my predecessor. Mm. And that's what began his disillusionment, I think, with government.
Should we have one final question?
Sure.
We were speaking of the NHS as well, and you said you were very proud of the reforms that took place. And we have an American friend who asked, do you think it's viable to transfer the NHS system to the US?
That's true,
just
Harris.
To finish on an international note.
Well, there's lots of people who would like to do that. And I was in the US as Health Secretary, a big conference that takes place every year, where there are some very strong advocates of an NHS system. I mean, it probably wouldn't have happened in this country if there wasn't a certain set of circumstances. I mean, it was fiercely opposed by the medical profession, fiercely opposed by the BMA, fiercely opposed at every level by the Conservative Party. But it's going back to what we were saying, that mood of not going back to the 30s, a big Labour majority, a real determination to do it from Attlee. And thank God, those things hadn't come together in that moment of history. I mean, it happened in Canada much later in the 60s. They adopted an NHS system. I can't see it ever happening in America, given the problems Obama has had just to introduce quite modest steps towards that. And, you know, with the debate being very pernicious about the NHS being some kind of part of the Russian Revolution, I can't see any politician in America ever introducing the NHS in its purest sense, but I can see them moving away from a system that is so awful in America, where so many people have no medical insurance at all, and those that do have seen it hiked up enormously over the last few years.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
For coming
it's been a
on.
Pleasure. Thank you.
This is Pulse.
This is Pulse.